The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, everybody. My name is Brian McManus, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholism jokes. I arrived in Philly 6 years ago. I'm originally from Houston, Texas. And I would say the third day I was here, I got an email from a drunken Scotsman. I didn't know he was a drunken. I knew he was a Scotsman at the time, but I didn't know how drunken he was. His name was Neil Ferguson. And he asked me to meet him at a bar called Oscar's. It's between 15th and Sansom. He had read some of my writing. He knew I had just moved to town, and he was interested in meeting up with me. And so I did at 2 o'clock on a weekday, and I believe we stayed there until about 10 o'clock. And I remember thinking two things. I remember thinking, I really love this bar, Oscar's. It's great. And I also remember thinking, I want this man's fucking job. He's been here since 2 o'clock. And so now I have his job, and I work two doors down from Oscar's, and it's nearly killed me. Not really, but and one thing I noticed when I was there is that unlike Houston and unlike the bars, the dives in Houston, which I went to many, Dan mentioned that I was a cook and a chef in Houston, and some of the bars downtown just wouldn't have us. We smelled too bad. We were too rowdy. And there were a couple bars downtown there, Charlie's 804 and Lone Star Saloon, both of which, one of which is closed, and the other is in the Houston version of the book I've written here for Philadelphia. We used to go in there, and it just seemed like anything went. And there were characters. And I noticed that one thing that was different in Philadelphia dives is that it seemed a lot more inclusive, especially Center City dives. I know Oscar's seems to have people of different age groups. Who's been to Oscar's? Anybody? Yeah, oh, all right. So you know this about the place. It's got a lot of different ethnic varieties, like different people from economic strata. There are young men sitting next to old men, people with skateboards sitting next to lawyers. Everyone in, you know, loves the Phillies, of course, but that's probably the only thing they share in common, and that they love 23-ounce beers that cost $3.25. So I noticed that was really cool about Oscar's and Center City dives in particular, so I started to go to more of them. I went to McGlinchey's, which, of course, Sarah's taken pictures of, Bob and Barbara's. We can give these places a hand if you'd like. Dirty Franks. Can I hear a Dirty Franks? Places like that that were just really great. And then I started going out to the neighborhood bars, and some of them were divey, some of them were just very, very key to their neighborhood. And there is a difference between dives and neighborhood bars. I've done a lot of talking about this with people in interviews, what the differences are between, say, a dive and a shithole. And and as we'll find later on, the difference is some of the shitholes actually have shit smeared on the walls. And it's not a pretty sight. But in the book, in the intro to the book, and I apologize to anyone who listened to Radio Times yesterday when she read this, it's my description of kind of the criteria of a dive. And I am now going to try to attempt to read this incredibly tiny print. I didn't realize how tiny it was. With my double vision. All right, I say in the book that dive bars are like pornography. You kind of know them when you see them. They're harder to find, but you know them. When you're in one, you can kind of feel what one is. And this is kind of the criteria I use to define one. The smell of stale air, a few hardscrabble regulars, low lighting, red light bulbs, ripped and worn leather booths or bar stools, wood walls, faux wood walls, photos of regulars past and present stapled to those walls, nicotine cake ceilings, surly service, a vague sense that someone might do you bodily harm, cheap, stiff drinks, jukeboxes oozing music to help mend a broken heart or help break it all the more, and the piece de resistance, something odd, out of place, or downright illegal, be it a dog on the bar stool, a baby on the bar, an old man playing tonsil hockey with a tranny in a booth, or a drunk sobbing loudly to no one but himself. In short, the type of shit that would get you kicked out of some place proper. There's an author named Arthur Mitchell who wrote a book called Up in the Old Hotel. It's a series of his writing for a magazine. And he writes in it about McSorley's, which is the oldest bar in New York City. And he asked the guy why he hasn't raised his prices in years. And the guy says, if I raise my prices a nickel, I'd hear a dime's worth of regret about it from my customers. And that's kind of what is a dive, too. They remain unchanged throughout time. And let's get into some of these slides, I guess. And we're running out of time. All right. This slideshow, by the way, is going to be kind of the dive bar of slideshows. It's not exactly working properly. That's the cover of the book you're all going to buy after this is done. The publisher is out of Brooklyn. They're called IG. It's just a boutique publisher. And when they approached me about what should be on the cover, they said, you know, well, we understand there's a place in South Philly called The Dive. You should put that on the cover because that's not at all literal. And I said, well, the thing about The Dive is it's a great place, and I've written a story about John Klein, who owns the place. He had a lot of trouble with L&I. And it's 5 years old, and there are way too many young people there for it to be. There aren't enough old people. So I fought really hard to get the dolphin on the cover. And by I fought really hard, I mean, like, exchanged 2 emails with my publisher. And I wanted someplace iconic. Everybody knows this sign. Even if you're too scared to go in, you've seen this place. And the last time I was there, I can understand why. I never understood why people were scared of it. But the last time I was there was actually after a friend's wedding, and I wore a tux to the dolphin. And suddenly, out of nowhere, some friends and I were talking to an middle-aged Ecuadorian man who was telling us his immigration story. And seemingly out of nowhere, these two guys just jumped him and broke his nose, like shattered his nose. I wouldn't say they broke it. They shattered it like fountains of blood pouring out of it. And then I thought, like, oh, okay, I get it. Yeah, this place is dangerous. Holy shit. Yeah. My wearing a tux has nothing to do with that story. I just thought you should know that I wear a tux. This is Beef Seeker's Inn. It's in the Great Northeast. It's on 3234 Red Lion Road. This place is really great. It's really, really well lit. So for a dive, that's kind of a different thing. But it's also that they drink draft buds and dunk shots of Canadian Club whiskey in them, which is really great. And the guy behind the bar is probably 400 pounds, and he wears really big basketball shorts. I remember thinking, like, that guy's got a good look. Really authentic. Yeah. All right. Billy's Boomer Lounge. This place is on 52nd and Locust. It's somewhat close to my house. And during the election, right before Barack took it, he actually gave a speech right out in front of this place. And so there are photos online of Barack Obama giving a last-minute stump. Like, he had Philly sewn up. I don't know why he came back here, but I guess he felt like it was necessary to get the vote out the day before. And so there are photos online of him, like, in front of this sign. When we went and took pictures for the bar, they thought we were L&I and we were there to shut them down. And they were really, really, really suspicious of us. They wanted to know what we were doing and what our intent was there. Let's move on to another Billy's Chili Pot. Oh, my God. This place, every time you call this place, a drunk answers the phone. And he does not work at Billy's Chili Pot. And so any questions you ask him, do you guys actually serve chili there? Yes, 15 types. Really, what's your most popular? Jim Bob's. What's in that? Mostly Jim Bob. Click. One night I was there, and they did not have chili, but they did have boiled eggs for 35 cents, which they gave to you in a styrofoam bowl and with a shaker of salt. And I did not eat one, but my friend Brian did. And let's give him a round of applause. He's here to He's still living. If I can try my best Brian imitation, I would say, tasty. Steve's tasty. It's funny to two people. One thing about this place is they have a lot of trophies on the wall from their softball league. I guess they really tear it up. Like, everybody in there could barely stand. But get them on a softball field, and they will rip you a new. And another thing is there was a really old man there who took a really violent spill while we were there, and it looked like he was dead. It was like planking before it was cool. He strewn out, and everybody walked up to him, and they're shaking him, like everything you're told not to do to someone who's just experienced a head trauma. Like, wake up, man, what the hell are you doing? And finally, he got up, and he started to walk out, and they were debating whether or not they should call him an ambulance or a cab. And they're like, no, just let him go, but he'll never make it, but just let him go. Also, someone stepped over him to play the Harley Davidson pinball machine, which was, I thought, was a loving gesture. Cookies Tavern is in South Philly. It's a marine bar. Yeah, some Cookies fans. Cookies was owned by a guy named Daddy Wags Wagner. He was a Marine. He did a few tours and a few wars. And every year there, he died in 2002 of a brain tumor. But every year there, they still have a really huge gathering of Marines from across the country. Because if you know, Ton Tavern, that's right. I was just about to get into that trivia. 1775, that's right. Some patriots here tonight. And so his daughter runs the place now, and she runs a tight ship, if she'll pardon the Navy pun. I'm terribly sorry. It gets a lot more cerebral later when Sarah's up here showing her gorgeous work. All right. Leo's Cafe. This place I've told a few stories about because it's when they read the book, it strikes them as like, what the hell was that all about? This is the place with the shit-covered walls. I was in there again with Brian and a friend of mine named Dr. Doug, who's a psychologist who got us out of a couple scraps. And this guy walked in, and everyone in the place just froze what they were doing. And they're like, you're flagged. Get the hell out of here. You're flagged. I don't know why I go into my Texas voice when I still, you're flagged. I don't know. How do you guys talk? You're flagged. You're so flagged. Get out of here. So they're like, you're flagged. Get out of here. And they all screamed at him, and he blinked in the sun and kind of stumbled out. And so I asked, like, what did that guy do? Why were you so upset with him? They're like, a couple weeks ago, he came in here and he smeared his shit all over the women's restroom. All right, that'll do it. That'll get you flagged from a place, I think. But I looked up, and there was still a to-be-repaired sign on the women's restroom door. Like, they're just like, oh, I'm not going to deal with that. We'll let somebody else deal with that. So that's DeLeo's, and I've probably said too many mean things about this place, but I did get the distinct feeling that everyone in this place was on meth. I mean, just really angry people. And if you're not one of their core 10 regulars that keep this place open, they know it instantly, and they stare at you accordingly. And some of them puff up their chest and tell stories about that asshole they beat up last night, and you're just like, I think he's sending us a signal, guys. I think he's sending us a signal. The next tavern. This place is not the Denix in Reading Terminal. So don't get them confused. This one's on 15th and Snyder. And I came in one night and sat right by the door. And the bartender came up and asked me what I wanted. And I ordered a beer or whatever. And she brought it to me and she said, why do you look so nervous? And I said, I didn't realize I did look nervous. I'm sorry about that. Should I be nervous? And she said, you asked too many fucking questions. And she walked away. And now there's a methadone clinic up the street from Denix. And I quickly learned that if you sit by the door, constant stream of people walk through the door and ask you for money. And the first few, the bartender gives you an assist. She's like, get the hell out of here. Like, she knows instantly it's someone from the clinic coming in. But then after a while, you have to just, oh, no, I'm sorry. And so I decided to move to the other side of the bar And but the restroom door was broken off, and there was someone taking a dump out there in plain daylight. So couldn't figure out which one was a better option. Friendly Lounge, this place is absolutely fabulous. If I can coin a phrase, I don't think absolutely fabulous is ever... this is owned by two twin brothers, Dominic and Marco. They took it over from their mother, who died in 71. It used to be a go-go bar. And the last time I was in there, a guy brought in a bag of what he said were polished stones because he wanted to trade them to Dominic, who he heard was a collector. So he dumped them on the bar, and they were just rocks. And he wanted to trade them for a beer, and Dominic said, "These are just rocks. I've got enough of these in my head. I don't need these. Get them off my bar." And then a group of about 20 guys, all wearing, they were on a dive bar pub crawl for a bachelor party. And like old city types, like, you know, I'm sorry if some of you are old city. I don't mean that as a project. You know what I mean. Come on. The beefy guys walked in there, and they all had matching shirts that were like, Jesse's bachelor party dive crawl. And the guy scooped up his rocks really quickly when he saw them crossing the street. He's like, "Holy shit, we're being invaded." And he ran out. Hideaway Inn, this place is in West Philly, right off of Baltimore and 51st Street. And it's really great. They serve fluorescent drinks in there. They must drop like light bulbs on them. They're crazy. And they have a wheel that you can spin to win things. You can pay a dollar to spin the wheel, but everything on the wheel is worth less than a dollar. So you can win a loaf of white bread or a can of tuna, but Oscar's Tavern. Yeah, this place is great. I wax poetic about it all the time, so you know it. I'll pass it. Anybody heard of this place? yeah, this is Ray's Happy Birthday Bar, which is, to my mind, the most authentically classic dive. You've got like a really great mix of old regulars and young people because they do karaoke nights that are, you know, a lot of fun. They have like spontaneous dance parties. There are quite a bit of characters from the neighborhood and just a tiny bit of a bleed over from the kind of the corner of Geno's and Pat's. What's funny is when those guys got to Friendly Lounge, the bachelor party, they're like, "We walked into Ray's Happy Birthday Bar up the street, but it was too scary," which is just weird. I think it's important that you can smoke in this place. You can't smoke in a lot of bars now, and in some of these Philly places in my book, I mentioned which ones you can smoke in. I think that's important. I think that the smell of cigarettes smoked 40 years ago is also kind of what makes a dive, but like the fact that you can see somebody light up in a place is still pretty divey. Let's see. Rosewood Bar. This place is in South Philly as well. It's I believe it's just right off of Oregon. It's on Rosewood and Shunk. And I got a call right after the book came out. We did some excerpts in the paper I work for, Philadelphia Weekly, and we ran this photo in the paper. And Robert Kipnicki, the owner of this bar, called me and left a voicemail, and he sounded very troubled. He's like, "Brian McManus, you need to give me a call back." And I was like, "All right, well, I'm on deadline. I'll call him back tomorrow." And so the next morning, he was in our office. And I was like, "Oh, man, this is bad." And so he came in, and he told me that, you know, he thought the word dive is an insult. And I told him why I didn't think it was. I told him that, to me, it's not a pejorative. It just means while everything around this bar changes, it always remains the same. I think that point is never more true than with Oscars. If you think about Sansom Street now, I was told at another reading that I did that it used to be the crown jewel 30 years ago of Sansom Street. Like, it was the bar. And now it's like the only bar on the street that's remained the same with all your sampans and your barbuzos and all the stuff going on around it. Like, it's like culinary paradise now. But this place, I told him, I was like, it just means authenticity to me. And that's what I mean about your bar. To that end, Marky Mark filmed a movie inside this bar. Called Invincible. Vince Papale, guys, come on, Eagles. It makes sense that they shot it in this bar because it was the movie took place in the 70s, and this place hasn't changed since the 70s. But anyway,
Next one? Next one? No? Is this it? Oh, my God. That's not it, is it? That's the last one. I was going to tell my own personal McGlinchey story before Sarah comes up. Well, it's not my story. It's a story a friend of mine told me about it. Was her name Bernadette, Sarah? Bernadette is, if you've been to McGlinchey, she's probably waited on you. She may have been rude to you. She's been rude to me, but you never take her personally. You're like, oh, it's all right. And apparently my friend owed her money. My friend Ryan owed her money and went to McGlinchey's to pay her. And he took a seat at the bar. He was waiting to see her, and he didn't. And so after about 10 minutes, the bartender, maybe even you, Sarah, I don't know. Oh, you know Ryan, so anyway. Asked him, like, are you here for Bernadette? And he said, I am, in fact, yeah. And she threw him a towel, and she's like, you're waiting on her, you're doing her shift tonight. She's a waitress. That was how he was paying her back, is to work her shift. That's me, I think. Hold on. How am I doing on time? This guy, you've done plenty. I wanted to tell one more story about a place right up the street from Billy's Boomer Lounge. It's called Cousin Danny's Exotic Haven. I was on Radio Times yesterday, and I guess Marty Moscoane read my review of Cousin Danny's, and it stood out to her, so she mentioned that bar, and she's like, what's up with this place? And I was like, oh, I've been there a lot. And then we just kind of moved on, and I just left that kind of floating in the air. Like, I go to this black strip club a lot called Cousin Danny's Exotic Haven because it's by my house. And so I wanted to, not that any of you mind, but I wanted to explain that I do bring guests to my home there quite a bit. We will drink for like 10 hours, and then we'll end up at Cousin Danny's just because it's always funny to see the looks on their faces and the conversations we get into. One of which was when I walked in there last time with my friend Dave. One of the dancers, right when we walked in, we were the only two white guys in the place. They said, evening, officers? So that was great. And then I've been told it's okay to go blue here just a little bit. And it was one of the strippers sat down next to me, and she was like, we talked for a minute, and she's like, you know, a lot of people tell me that white people have tiny dicks. But I've seen some pornos. Y'all got beautiful dicks. It's as though she had X-ray vision, is what I'm saying. And with that, Sarah, I guess.
I was just saying, that's kind of a hard place to start. But thank you for coming tonight. My name is Sarah Stolfa. I was a bartender for longer than my stint at McGlinchey's, but I'll just talk about that part of my career life while I was at McGlinchey's. So I worked there probably about 9 or 10 years. It's really hard to remember because something about that place really swallows up time. Even at working there after 8 years, I was still one of the newest employees. So just to give you context, some people have been there for 30-plus years. So I started working there, and as Daniel said, I came to Philadelphia as part of a band, and I like to think I was slightly a punk rock queen, maybe not top 40, but, you know, in our own world. I quickly left the band after relocating here, but was still working at McGlinchey's, and about 6 years into my stint there, I decided that this wasn't really the career path that I wanted to continue on for the rest of my life. How many of you have been to McGlinchey's? You wouldn't say that the people that work there are probably the friendliest of the bunch. And I have to admit that I was definitely the least friendly. We would read a lot of times, and I love you, I hate you, the column, I forget which paper it's in the city paper, and like every so often there would be something about a waitress or a bartender at McGlinchey's, and we would guess as to which one it was. And most of the time people were guessing me. So about 6 years into this, I decide that this is no longer where I need to go, where I want to go with my life, and I need a way out. And so I figured I'm going to go to school. And I had a vague interest in art and a real big fear of commitment. So I signed, I went to school at the Art Institute for 2 years, signed up for there because it was only a 2-year program, and that was about all that I could handle. Being in my first history of photography class, I saw the work of Robert Frank and the book The Americans, and it just blew my mind. And I just realized the power that photography could be. So at that point, I decided to transfer out to a school that had a 4-year program, which was Drexel. Going along my photographic studies, working at McGlinchey's to put myself through, I hit a block. It's kind of like a writer's block, but I called it a photographer's block. And I had no idea what to photograph. And I went to one of my instructors, and I was like, you know, I can't do this class because I don't know where to go. I don't know what I'm supposed to photograph. And he said, look at your life and look at the parts of your life and see if you could draw something from there. Well, at that point, my life was living in a really bad apartment situation, a boyfriend who was totally nuts, and McGlinchey's. So I was like, okay, I'll try McGlinchey's. So I went to work with my camera one night, and I shot about 6 or 7 rolls, just stuff. I didn't know what I was looking for. And I had my film process, went back to school, started printing for class, and I printed this photograph. I had it out at Drexel. We were printing in darkrooms back then, and outside of the darkrooms was a communal table. And so I had the printout there. And I could hear my instructor start yelling my name, Sarah, 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 and banging on my darkroom door. And he said, that printout there is a beautiful picture. Don't ever tell me you're going to quit again. So the regulars began. So I continue to photograph the portraits, and I'm not the people that came into the bar, and I'm not a photographer that sits in my room and conceptually decides what my project is going to be and then go out and execute. I have a real kind of interaction and communication with my work in that I make work, and then I start to figure out what I'm doing. And so when I started this body of work, I really kind of at first thought about it in terms of my nights behind the bar. McGlinchey's, the bar, for those of you who haven't been there, the bar is a circle bar. And so bartenders walk around the bar for 9 hours, 10 hours a night. And so I just started to think of it in that term. And like I said, I wasn't a very chit-chatty bartender. So I didn't really care. I actually really didn't like my clients. It's funny I say clients now. I never would have said clients back then. But I didn't really like my clients. And it wasn't them that I didn't so much like. It was where I was in my life that I didn't like. So I really felt very separated from them. Like I go in, I make my money, and then I leave. And that was it. And then all of a sudden, so I thought of this as like my, you know, nameless people across the bar, my endless, you know, route around the bar each night. And then I submitted the work to the New York Times for a student competition. And stayed up till 2 in the morning the night before getting the stuff ready, just figuring out there's no way I'm going to win. The very next day I send it in, postmarked, made it, you know, just made it on deadline. And I won. And when I won, they published there were some other prizes, like some cash and a camera. But the biggest thing was that they published nine of the photographs, something like that, in the New York Times Sunday magazine. That was huge. Thank you. For me. First competition, if there's any photographers out there, there's some little things. But, like, that was the first competition I ever entered. So, you know, if you're a photographer or any artist, you got to submit your work to competitions. But anyway, so I called it. I'm great. I won. Awesome. You know, they're like, okay, so we need the names. And I was like, the names? And they're like, yeah, you know, we need the names of the people that we're going to run. I was like, but they're the nameless, faceless people, you know, behind the bar, on the other side of the bar. And they're like, we're the New York Times. I was like, yeah, but this is my artistic intention. They're like, We're a newspaper. We need the names. I was like, okay, no problem. When do you need them by? They're like, tomorrow morning. Well, the good thing about McGlinchey's is that it's full of regulars. And so I could get to the bar. I had to work that night. And so I just started asking. If I didn't know the person's name, I knew their friend that came into the bar, and I asked them. And so I just kind of started picking up the names. One of the guys was a stagehand, so I ran around to all the theaters. I brought all the pictures with me and said, who is this guy? Do you know this guy? And there was one I was missing. And so I finally, in desperation, taped the photograph to the front door of the bar and put a sign on it and said, if you know this person, see the bartender. And someone came in at 1:45 yelling, Roy Miranda, Roy Miranda. So I had all my pictures. I had all my names. But the thing is that that incident all of a sudden really changed the way I thought about my pictures. All of a sudden, these nameless people had names. And so I started titling the names of the people, titling the photographs the names of the people. You might have noticed there's a very consistent vision in the work in that the subject is always kind of centered in the frame. And so I was using what is considered a very formal way of making portraiture for the regulars of a dive bar. So there was kind of a contrast in subject and form that I was really interested in. And the other thing that started to happen is I started to like my regulars, even the ones that we had the worst names for, and I won't share any of them. She had one. But even the ones that, you know, I couldn't stand, who had, you know, not tipped me in the 5 years that I had been serving them, all of a sudden, they were beautiful to me because I started to relate to them through my pictures. And I started to think about each detail of each person and how it was really beautiful and how each distinct detail made them who they were and all their flaws. But somehow, by taking their picture, it became beautiful. This is Jess Chabelle. And here's another thing about the regulars. I don't have any idea of photography being truth or a document, but I had this thing in my head that I wouldn't move people around. So wherever the person came into the bar, that's where I photographed them. And as I continued to photograph, I had my favorite walls. So Jess always sat on the wrong wall. The other thing that she did all the time is she was always with people. And you may have noticed that in the photographs, I only photograph people alone. And there is a reason for that. I'll talk about that in a second. But I waited 4 months for her because I couldn't, every time she came in, she was with people or she sat in the wrong part of the bar. And the one time she came in by herself, she was wearing all black. And so finally the night, I knew she'd come back. So I knew it was just a matter of time before I could photograph her. And so finally she came in by herself, wearing color. So the reason why I photograph people alone is because I really actually wasn't interested in documenting McGlinchey's. McGlinchey's ended up being my backdrop, kind of my stage, and I would wait for my characters or models to walk through. And McGlinchey's was the perfect spot. Brian kind of talked about it, but, you know, the Center City bars have a little bit of everything. You know, everyone loves cheap drinks. And so we would get, you know, the 10 a.m. gin drinker, the college student, the young professional after work. We got a little bit of everything. But I wasn't interested, I mean, those ideas run through the work, but I wasn't interested in portraying McGlinchey's as this kind of like Cheers environment, you know, where everyone knows your name and it's full of activity. There's something, when you're bartending in the same place for 7 to 8 years, you start to notice something about people when they're coming into a bar, especially when they're coming into a bar alone. And so I was really interested in pulling these people from the environment, from the commotion of the bar. I mean, McGlinchey's, I would go in during the day to photograph, but I would also photograph during my shift. I worked three nights a week, including Fridays and Saturdays, and I would just bring my camera and stash it underneath the cash register and pull it out when I wanted to photograph. But there is something very tranquil or about pulling these people out of that environment. And also, people act really different when they are with other people and are photographed. You know, you ask somebody to take their picture when they're with somebody, and it's all goofy kind of gestures and smiles. And that wasn't what I was interested in. There's something about someone being in a bar when they're by themselves, where they are open to being interacted with, but also kind of self-conscious. And that self-consciousness becomes even more heightened when all of a sudden my camera is in front of them. And so the photographs themselves are about 2 feet by 2 feet. And so it's really important that there's this sense of that they're almost life-size when you're looking at them, so that when you're looking at them, you can start to relate to that person. And it's interesting because I had a show at a coffee shop up in Connecticut. And when the pictures came down, people were upset because they became so, they so much enjoyed creating their own stories for the people. So this body of work became a book in 2009, and it's called The Regulars. And it was really important to me. I wish I had your editor, because my editor and I fought like crazy. And one thing that was really important, I wrote an essay in the book, and one thing that was really important is that these photographs don't have text underneath them. Because the photographs, in a way, they're about these people, but at the same time, they need to be separated from themselves so that you and I and someone who doesn't know them can start to glean and relate to them on their own, in their own way. So when I would photograph, I would take a whole roll, and the camera that I was using, it wasn't like, you know, it's funny because I would say, oh, can I take your picture? And they'd say, sure. And then I would pull out my camera that ended up being this big. And so it became a really, and in a dark bar with a flash. And so it became a really kind of obtrusive event. And so I would really take my time because I wanted to see how they would interact with the camera. I wanted to see that public face that we, you know, are presented with people all the time, if I could see that fade. In some of them, I think there's some humor, but I do think that in a lot of them, or in the work as a whole, there is this kind of gravitas or seriousness to it. Part of it is, you know, the lighting, the mood of it, but also the expression of it. And it was really important that the structure of the photographs was the same in each one, because I want people to notice the difference between each person. You know, how the hands are fitted, what that person decides to put in front of them at the bar. McGlinchey's is, I don't know if this is a dive bar thing, but McGlinchey's is one of those bars where you kind of just empty out your pockets and put it onto your, what's in front of you. And all of a sudden the things that you have become part of you, part of your identifying factors. And so, you know, how the hands were held, what they decided to put in front of them in front of the bar. It became, I mean, the bar itself became a still life. Does anyone know Fred that works at McGlinchey's? if you've been to McGlinchey's, you've been served by Fred. If you've been there on the weekends, he's been there for 30 years. But God bless his heart. This was taken on a Friday night at 1:45, which is last call. And I said to Fred, I am so sorry I need to do this to you, but I need to take this picture. Is that all right? And if you've never been at McGlinchey's for last call, it's like a zoo because everybody wants to get their last drink in. And he let me do it. You know, and so things, the little tiny details become beautiful. And even things that I didn't notice when I was photographing, like the little leaf in her hair or the necklace or the little tattoo that's peering out. And so this place that I had been in for so long and that I was dying to get out of all of a sudden became my ticket out. So with this body of work, not only did I win that contest, but I got accepted to a master's program. And so I left McGlinchey's in order to go back to school. And I'm happy to say that was about 5 years ago. The funny part, though, is that I'm still, more times than not, I'm still known as the bartender from McGlinchey's and I'm known as Sarah the photographer. And that even carried over when I was in school. I went to school at Yale in New Haven, Connecticut, and we had a class that we would go to the MoMA every week to look at photographs from the collection. And so I was walking to the MoMA with a classmate of mine, and on the way there, this white van goes by, and this guy yells out, "Hey, can I get a lager?" So, with the end of my bartending stint at McGlinchey's, that was the end of the body of work, and it was a really nice way to close and move on to the next part of my life. So, thank you very much. Hello.
Hey.
All right, 10 minutes, guys. Who's got a question? Aren't there people on the side that are going to hand out microphones? All right. Am I supposed to pick them, or are you? Okay. Gentlemen up front.
Mr. McManus.
Yes, sir.
Extended welcome to Philadelphia.
Thank you.
I was fortunate enough to grow up at 52nd and Catherine, which sort of put me in between Billy's Boomer and The Hideaway, and have also passed by, like, Oscars. Did you ever hit any of the spots with, like, sawdust on the floor?
People keep talking to me about sawdust on the floor, and I've not seen it in any of the bars that I went to for my book. I don't know if it's, like, a relic of bars past or what that's about, but I know in Texas and kind of like saloon-type places, they had peanut shells and sawdust on the floor, but I've not seen that here. I don't know. I went to probably about 120 bars for the book, and I didn't see it anywhere. Yeah, that's what my liver says. All right. Next.
Sure, the guy in the blue in the back.
My question is for Brian McManus. Brian, what's the weirdest thing that ever happened to you at Oscar's bathroom?
This is a loaded question. Joel knows me. And he knows very well that we've shared some moments in that restroom. None of which I'm going to tell tonight. But in the restroom? I know exactly what he's talking about. There's a guy named Sutron who goes to Oscar's and he hits on every woman in the bar. And apparently one night I scuffed his shoe on the way to the bar. And while I was taking a piss, he confronted me about it. Like this close to my face. You know, when you step on a man's shoe, you apologize. Like, and I was like, really? I've got my thing. Oh, it was weird. And I managed to talk him out of beating me to death in the restroom while my penis was in my hand, which score one for me. Steve Volk.
I'm just curious what you've been working on lately since the regulars.
I started to do a body of work where I was traveling around the country looking at the physical and kind of cultural landscape. After McGlinchey's photographing for 3 years in one room, I really felt the need to really change what I was doing. So I went out into the world, changed cameras. So I was working on that for a while. And then I got out of grad school, and life took some crazy turns. Marriage, opened up a nonprofit photography center, and had a baby, all within a year and a half. So I've been pretty grounded. But I've been working on work that ends up being much more central to my personal life. You know, the kind of shifts and changes that my family life has taken.
I have one question for Brian.
Sure. And also I just want to read something really quick because my home bar closed.
Oh, no.
Yeah, there are these two really well-known bars that I know it's, like, really not cool to, like, talk about L.A. and New York when you're in Philly. But my home bar was Mars Bar, and it was slated in the East Village, and it was slated to close. And I just got a text right before this started, and it said it was slated to close because they were demolishing the building. But this is pretty funny. The New York City Health Department officials have confirmed that they ordered the closure of Mars Bar today because of a litany of health code violations. The department said that the inspectors observed about 850 fruit flies in various areas of the restaurant and in a bottle of alcohol. So I just think that's, like, so, like,
what's perfect. The problem? What's the problem?
I know, right?
And?
Exactly. And then I was just curious. Yeah, I'm kind of in mourning, and I'm looking for a new place. And there's a place that I've been kind of afraid to go to. It's kind of a strange neighborhood. It's off of City Line. It's like there's the Pathmark back there, and it's behind the what's it? Yes.
Oh,
I was just wondering, is that in your book?
Are we talking about Five Points Cocktails Bar? Is that what,
Five Points? Yeah, that's what I thought it was.
That is in the bar, and it's or in the book rather, and it's a great place. It's really huge, and they have, like, fish fries there. It's a really happy place. It's like they have old school DJs that come in and play songs from the 50s, and people, you know, have dance parties and fish fries, and they serve some really fluorescent drinks there too. I would recommend you go. Yeah, it's a fun place. You, sir, here in the white.
Sarah, one of the things that I noticed about all of the photos is a consistent piece would be the cigarette pack and the lighter and the like. And, of course, that's changed with the new laws about that. I mean, when you look back on those photos, because there seems to be kind of a deliberateness between in where they put it. You know, it's like a little tiny part of the story. But, of course, now it's not there. If you were to do those photos today, it's a prop, if you will, that's gone. Would they be different photos without that and the gesture that people put into how they position their pack and the lighter and the like and the ashtray?
I haven't been to McGlinchey's. Actually, I went by McGlinchey's, and I didn't go in because it was smoky. So the photographs would still be the same at McGlinchey's because I think they do smoke. They're allowed to smoke there. But I do think that the cigarettes and the lighter become important. I feel like, you know, you start to identify people or you start to make ideas about these people. And I think how each person would claim their space. I mean, McGlinchey's, they like pack the bar, you know, like the stools are really hard to get out. So people would claim their space. And I think where they would put their items was part of that. And so I think, it adds another layer to the pictures. And the red hat. There was one incident. I'm represented by a gallery in town at 21st and Pine called Gallery 339. And, I had a, a solo show there in 2006 of this work. And one of the people in the pictures came in and was very upset about it. But fortunately, another thing for any photographers out there, I had model releases signed by everybody. So there was really nothing that could be done. But most people have been very supportive of it. You know, I've had regulars come and you give talks. I've had people in the book who, you know, have bought the book and wanted me to sign it. So most people, you know, I think have been fine with it.
You, sir, here in the middle.
No, the McGlinchey's, the nice thing about the owner is two brothers that own it, Ronnie and Shelley, and obviously they have a pretty laid-back way of running their business. They haven't done much it qualifies it as a dive because they don't do much. And so they didn't really care. As long as it didn't infringe them or cause any problems, they were fine with it. The only thing was that I had to ask someone if they could be photographed. But they were really kind of... You know, when I gave them a book, they're like, oh, thanks. They don't really care either way.
Yeah, you, sir?
In the stripe.
I'll ask that same question if you do.
I mentioned Robert Kipnicki of Rosewood Bar. He came in, and I gave him my spiel about how I thought dives are just authentic. And he actually read... the intro, read his review in front of me, which was actually kind of nerve-wracking, and then he bought 5 books. So and which was cool. And he told me that before he came to see me, that he had spoken to his nephew, who told him like, oh, you know, this is actually not a big deal. This is kind of cool. Like it's not as big an insult as you thought. He's been to a couple of the bars around him that are in the book, to Nick's Tavern, places like that. And he's like, I work really hard to not have my place be a toilet like that place. And that kind of speaks to the I use a rating system in the book that kind of helps. I think there's a bunch of different shades of dives, some of which aren't exactly divey, but kind of, and then some like DeLeo's, which are just absolutely filthy, and you feel like you're going to be stabbed at a moment's notice. And the threes in the book, I rate from 1 to 5, and I think the threes in the book are kind of the places I really like a lot and would go back to. McGlinchey's is a 3. Rosewood Bar was a 3. I explained that to him, and he seemed to be cool with it. Did you say last one? Last one, make it count.
Hey, Sarah, so you were talking about in your photos that when people look at it, they feel like they can relate to the people more, but you had also said that when they look at it, they kind of make up their own story for the people. So is it really... that observers are relating to it, or they're just making up their own stories? Now, I hope that doesn't like sound like a petty question. I did really like your photographs. I was just wondering what people were observing.
I think it's kind of both. I mean, I think the power of art is that you will look at it and respond to it in some way, and hopefully in multiple ways. And so I think one of the great things about portraiture is that it has the ability for the viewer to try to relate to the people, but then also, you know, by taking a portrait that's so specific, it becomes almost general in that other people can relate to it. And so, you know, I think we just talk in stories, you know? The thing that everyone laughed at was when Brian and I told a story about something. And so I think that... And, you know, storytelling is the oldest tradition. And so I think that it's just engraved in us to tell stories. And so I think it's one of the ways that we relate. It's probably the biggest way in way we relate to each other.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.